Okay, so we're going to start, and this is the, this is not just calculus, this is light calculus in Oakland. So, light calculus, I hear some light calculus. Yeah! Okay, so I'm going to start. So about a month and a half ago, I live in Oakland, right, keep in mind. So about a month and a half ago, I come out to my car, and I'm ready. I'm going to go into the office. It's early. I'm going to get the update. I was excited. I was on time. It was about 7:30. I was leaving the house. And I come to my car, and the window's broken, right? And I say, oh, shit, my window's broken. Okay, so I say, okay, right away, I hear cha-ching, and I see dollar signs, and I think Maureen, right? And people who know how finances work, they know they have to go through Maureen to get what they need, what's necessary. So I say, okay. So a month and a half later today, my window is still broken. It's covered by tape. It's now beginning to rain. So it's becoming a bit of an issue, right? So okay. So then, 3 days ago, 3 or 4 days ago, I come out of my house, right? And still with my car, I come out of my house and the trunk is open, right? And I say, oh, and I'm, you know, it's tired. I'm tired. It's early. I walk over. I say, oh, I close the trunk. I say, oh, okay, I got to make sure I don't do that anymore, right? So then, one day, right? So I was on the piano and I was playing a couple of the Bach inventions. I'm working on number 13. It's a really good one. And I think to myself, okay, yeah, me and John Craig, we're working on learning some of these inventions that we can play them at the cadre school, right? So I go outside, right, to my car, which is where my violin was. He plays cello, I play violin. And I notice that, you know, my violin's not in the trunk, right? So I start freaking out, and I say, okay, I look in the office, I look in my parents' house, I look in my house, my violin's not there. So what ended up happening is that it got stolen, right? I was very upset. I'm still a little bit upset. My violin got stolen. So the next morning, after I figure out that my violin got stolen, I walk out of my house, right? And there's a parking ticket on my car. There's one of these bright green. You can tell you get a parking bright green ticket. And I think, cha-ching, oh, my God, Maureen, right? I got to get my window. Now I got this parking ticket. I got all these, you know, bridge tolls that are overdue. Sorry, Deborah, right? So I'm thinking, okay, damn, you know, my violin got stolen, I got a parking ticket, and then today I go and get my Science Christian Economy book and it's wet. You know, when books get wet, they get puffy and they get, you know, wavy, right? So I'm thinking, and then we were driving down here, I'm thinking, why is this happening to me, right? My violin, my car, I got all these tickets, my book, all these things. I'm getting, like, very fixated on some things that just really don't mean much in the large scale. So what I then figured, and then Joel and John started telling me about the book of Job, how Job had had all these things. He was wealthy. He had, you know, large family and all these things going for him, and he was happy, and something happened. So he met Satan or something, or Satan talked to God, and Satan said, well, you know, you should test Job. God, you should see whether or not if you take, and this is why Job loved God so much, is because he had all these things, right? He had all these, he had all these things that he liked and that made his life better and he was happy. And so Satan says, you know, God, why don't you test Job? Why don't you begin to just, you know, take away some of these things and see if he still loves you, right? And so what ended up happening is that he gets all his things taken away. He catches some disease that makes him ugly, and he has all these boils all over his face and stuff. But he does maintain his devotion, and he does maintain his love of God, right? And I thought about that. I said, okay, all these things are happening. And I really thought about it. And then I reflected to Wednesday, which was the day after Tuesday, which was the day after the election. And I went. We went to Berkeley. We organized in the morning. We had a half day because I think a lot of us were really distraught over the outcome of the election. But we organized, and then, you know, this is the only time it's ever happened, right? But, like, every single person that I said something to stopped to get into a discussion. And all I really said was people would walk by and I would say, hey, do you know the election is being stolen right now? They were walking by and they all stopped and they said, yeah. And this used to happen, but is happening in much more frequently now. People said, okay, well, what do we do? Right? And they just looked at, and this happens, right? You get blocked, you know, you tell people, you know, no, you're fucked up, you think this and this and that, and we got a culture that's doing this and this and that, right? And Bush and Cheney, they're all this. And we kind of get into a thing where we argue with people sometimes, and we get real fixated on the argument. But these people on Wednesday, the day after the election, were looking at me with a look in their eye of complete fear of demoralization, because a lot of what I got leading up to the election was, don't worry about me, I'm voting for Kerry. You don't have to worry about California. Nobody's stupid enough to vote for Bush again. Couldn't possibly happen. We've all seen what happened. And these people were genuinely scared and genuinely needing leadership. And what generally used to happen to me in a position like this was I said, oh, you know, well, what do we do? Right? Like I would kind of be taken aback and given pause asking when they ask, what do we do? So what this panel is going to go through is the kind of give some life to or kind of put into the forefront of people's minds of, okay, what do we do? What really do we do? Because the most simple answer in that kind of case when somebody asks you, say, well, what do you do? I say, well, take responsibility. You know, it's that simple. And then they say, well, take responsibility for what? They say, do what? And they say, he likes all these trains. He likes trains. He's part of John Birch Society and all types of things about LaRouche. And I say, well, you know, the essential issue is to take responsibility. Take responsibility for uncovering some of the things that we work on in terms of calculus, in terms of the light, the music, the political situation. Take responsibility for these things and also for the country and for the minds of the people in this country and really around the world once we start getting America on track. Because the thing with after this weekend, you know, we're here. It's nice. You can see, you know, hundreds of stars, which you don't get in the city. It's enjoyable. But when we're done on Sunday, we're going to go back to our respective locals, either Oakland or wherever else you're from. If you flew out here from the East Coast or something. And we're going to be going back into a population that right now is dominated by a culture that allowed for 60 million people to vote for Bush again. A culture in terms of a way of thinking, right? In terms of a method of thinking. A culture that allows for denial to take hold on a mass scale. So this is what we're going into. Some of us are going to go back to this culture and seek to use it to protect ourselves and hide and enfold ourselves in the nice, you know, fold of escape, right? Be pleasurable. And some of us, I think all of us should go back to fight it, to fight this question. So we're going back. Now, Cody brought up an interesting point. I thought it was important to look at what could be, given people who have been around for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 4 years, people who have been around have a sense of how the crisis has been developing, have a sense of the kind of just, you know, expose after expose that we put out on the entire administration. And if this type of thing is exposed, it was a good idea. It could potentially be a case where politics is turned upside down, right? Now, I can almost guarantee that as it stands right now, it won't be the Democratic Party that does it, right? If anybody's going to do it, it will have to be us. And what should come out of this discussion, what should come out of this panel, what should come out of the rest of the weekend, and when we do go back to this culture, whether or not we're going to sit in the shit or whether or not we're going to fight it, what should be in the forefront of everybody's mind is whether or not they're right now exercising a method that's going to give them the capability to overcome the culture that has allowed for 60 million people to vote for Bush again, right? The culture that would allow for me to be paralyzed over the loss of an object. Right, say my violin or, you know, green tickets on the car, something like this. So I want to read a quote, and then we're going to get into the meat of it. Right, it's important. It's an important question of method. It says this is from a pedagogical, it's on the transfinite principle of light. This is by Jonathan Tannenbaum, and it says, It's difficult or even virtually impossible in today's dominant culture to relive a scientific discovery without first clearing away the cognitive obstacles reflected in the tendency to reject or run away from the essential subjectivity of science. I'm going to read it again. Because what Cody was describing in the beginning about an emotional, irrational response to the election and things like this, we should all reflect on. I'm going to read it again, and then we're going to start. It's difficult or even virtually impossible in today's dominant culture to relive a scientific discovery without first clearing away the cognitive obstacles reflected in the tendency to reject or run away from the essential subjectivity of science. If people are kind of fuzzy on subjectivity, it'll be gone over the next hour.
So yeah, so I was kind of wanted to go over a little bit of. We just found out we're going to do this class this morning, right now. But, because if people remember like some of the responses they would get to people when they would were out organizing at a table, and they you knew that George Bush might get reelected. This guy said, you know, this guy Dick Cheney is his boss and wants to go to war with Iran. You guys remember like who here can remember some of the famous responses you got from people when you tell them that, when you tell them, you know, join us, we got to stop these guys. Yeah, that's a famous one, yeah. I never get that when preaching in the choir, because I've heard some bad choirs. Is there any other ones? Yeah, yeah.
Got my own revolution, man.
Yeah. All right, yeah. I already voted, I know. The movie. Oh, the movie. Yeah, right. The movie.
But,
well, that one's a little more. That's something else. That's like an added quality to that one. But yeah, I had asked this before when we done this class last Saturday. But it's interesting because, you know, it seems that all of these different things that people say, they seem to all reflect the same method, you know. Because what is someone really thinking when they're saying that? I mean, because do they really just, I mean, to think that, does it seem reasonable to say that, you know, not being political when you've got, you know, fascism on the brink is some, you know, does that seem right? Yeah, it reflects, you know, this idea that, you know, first off, I think it comes from a different conception, which is that more real, that they feel, first off, you know, that people are being controlled, you know, by large financial interests that they might not feel they can change. You know, a lot of people, I've heard people, they're like, yeah, you can't change these guys. You know, you got to have money. You got to have power. If you want to get in with them, you gotta work the system. And if that's the case, if you don't believe that there's actually anything outside of just being controlled by an oligarchy, then it makes sense, because then it's like, okay, well, these guys out on the corner trying to organize to change all this stuff that's happening, you know, collapse the hospitals and not getting paid for working, and all this. And it makes sense because, you know, if you really want to survive, you're going to have to, you know, get along with these guys. You're going to have to somehow get in with them. You know, you don't want to be like that bum down the corner. You want to, you know, you want to actually get some money, get some esteem, respect. But And this is also fun because this is like this. I don't think the Christian fundamentalist approach is much different either, because I think because who is God? You know, if you just gotta go along with these guys, you know, because I think some of these Christian fundamentalists think that God is like the big boss, you know, and he's like, because you know he's got like the probably the most money, you know, he's got the most power. So, you know, God, if you get with God, then you don't have to worry. You know, you just he'll take care of you.
The Godfather.
The Godfather, yeah. But, yeah, but all these things, they all have, like, the same problem. I mean, it's, you know, because really this oligarchical system, it can't work. People really know it's not going to work, but they're stuck within this kind of system of thinking, which is necessary to break out of this is a different method, where these guys are all, where we have to actually, do what's because we actually have a power that's not in any of this stuff. We have we know that, like, you can come to figure out over the course this weekend that we actually do have. And we can reason out the things that we can actually do to change the situation. We have, I would say, you know, that there's not really, you know, the only thing that you can really, you know, have a, I guess the, yeah, it's like the only thing. It's the only thing that's really reasonable at all to do is to actually address this crisis. I mean, it doesn't, like any other thing, it just doesn't really make sense in the long term. It's just you're just prolonging what's going to happen to you. But I want at this point to actually try to, you know, bring in an experiment here. You guys are still having trouble seeing it? Maybe a couple. You can hold it. I guess you should hold it.
Yeah, then you can like stand in a chair and do it.
You can hold it sideways. I don't know if you can all see it sideways. Thank you.
eclipses, right?
Stand on the chair back there.
So people know what ellipses, right? I can hear you. If I don't know if you can hear me. I don't know if you could all hear me or not. You're not going to answer my questions?
Well,
okay, yeah. Well, you have a curve. You have a, which is, it's got two foci to it. But you could, well, actually you could show like what it's doing right now. And now the light's being shown from one of the foci.
Yeah.
And if you shine the light from...
Hey, Leona, can you shine it from the bottom one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
There's no top.
Is it working? So do you want to see what's happening here?
Yeah. It always goes to the same point.
Can you guys actually see the other foci? By what it just did, even though you can't see it, like, drawn in? It is drawn in, but it's kind of dirty.
Yeah, you can see it's a black dot.
Yeah, that might work actually. Better. Hey, I just turn. You can turn the lights on for a second, I guess. I don't know. Just and this is a curve. The way that we generate, you generate an ellipse is actually interesting.
Well,
Yeah, we're going to go through the ellipse, and then we'll come back and we'll show it again.
You guys have probably all generated a circle if you've used a compass. How many people have used a compass here? All right. Good job. All right. So, you know, you can figure it out. You know, you pick a point, and then you find a certain length, and you propagate that length. Circular action. So I have a fixed length right here. It's not stretchy, and I'm not going to cheat. Divide it into two, I get like two center points, and split it apart just a little tiny bit. Okay? You wanna and stand right here.
Hey, talk louder, please.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Just talk loud.
All right. Can anybody hear me like this? Is this loud enough? Or louder? Okay. No response. Okay.
Your lack of response is taken as a yes.
Okay, so can I have two fingers now? Let me slide in here. Okay.
Now watch closely.
So I'm not cheating. There's no stretching in this band. Okay. We've got two centers now, and you know, it looks kind of just like a slightly egg-shaped figure. What? Okay, now let's try, you know, pulling it apart a little bit further. Let's try pulling the two points apart a little further. Want to try that? Farther, yeah. Closer than that. Okay, that's good. Let's try this again.
Watch out.
Oh. Fingerprints here. Okay. So, is that starting to look familiar?
Yes.
All right. So, So did you guys actually see how you would at home generate this oval or this, I'm sorry, ellipse? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so where is it? So let's look at this again. Where's the tape? Now you can all say that you know what an ellipse is. How to generate it.
Okay, dinner will be served.
Dinner will be served shortly. It'll be popcorn.
you see what's happening is you've got this this light is actually being has its place at one of the foci that we have the string wrapped around it, and it's being shined and reflected off the surface of this ellipse. It's coming up to the other foci. No matter where you, as long as you keep the point, as it rotates, as the source of light rotates around the one foci, it continuously hits the other foci. Yeah, it's kind of hard to see.
I was trying to see if you guys could actually find it without actually, you know, having to see it.
If you do it really fast, you can see it. Yeah, the hand is being rotated around this foci, which is right here.
Actually, I could try to do it like this. Might be able to see it like this. Yeah. But then it's... Okay. I think you guys are just seeing enough. Okay, you guys are just playing with me. You've seen enough. okay. Question. What's going on? Why does it do that? Why is it going? Oh, sorry. Why is the light doing that? Why is the light going to the other foci? Anyone have any, hypotheses? Okay, that's a good description. Yeah. Okay. Question is why? Any other guesses or hypotheses? Come on, be brave.
You thought this is going to be a class where we told you all the answers, huh?
You've got a source of light.
Yes.
And a direction. I guess the way it's, the direction it's pointing is constantly changing. Then it's constantly hitting a new point on that surface, that curve. But for some reason or other, that curve makes it reflect to the same point. So I don't know if there's... That's just like the observation. And I don't know why, if you've got the strings when you drew the ellipse on the board, I can see why. I can see the process of how the ellipse is being formed. You've got the strings at the top. You can see that that's why I'm drawing the ellipse. But why would the light act in the same way? Why would it always reflect to the same point? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Why would the light?
That is my question, yeah.
Wait, I got something. I always wonder, is the light copying what the string did and that method of constructing the ellipse, or is the string copying what the light does?
Some pretty smart light. Cecilia?
I don't know what exists like first, string or light.
A laser light only has one color, and it's very sharp. It's very thin. It's just easier to use. Otherwise, you get a big glare.
I
guess like the circle, you know, like if there's one old guy who sitting around a circle and he's at one point, so when they separate it.
Del Canto.
They go for the circle, right? You focus the light on the middle of the circle, right? You send it around. It'll always be that same point. Well, there'll be light going to that same point. So when you separate the foci, you're doing essentially the same principle. But like, it's like you're separating the issue too. And you're still using the curve will always affect the fixed.
Wow, you guys would make really good modern art majors.
I think he has been done something. I think the stream is mimicking what the light does.
Okay.
I think it's the least action principle.
What does that mean?
I think that the light is trying to take the shortest distance. I think it's reflecting off the aluminum. And then it's taking the least distance to. Oh man, I don't know. I think that there's least action principle in here somewhere.
Is that what your teacher told you?
If you were to do the same thing with a circle, that would cause a square, right?
What?
If you do the same thing but with a circle, right?
No.
When you
do
a square?
Did you want to show us? Oh, okay.
Describe it.
Yeah. It's just like the same thing as that, same as this, but it's a circle instead. Now, if you took the light and you brought it around, wouldn't it create the square?
Yeah. You could, but if you're starting with the center, starting with the foci, so just return back to the foci.
I'm not going to answer the question why the universe requires that. Why one focus on the other, but I could see a reason why the light couldn't do anything else. Okay? And the example with a circle would help explain that. Because it's simple. And if you have a circle and you have a light starting from the center, I mean, the beam has to take some path anyway. But if it takes a path that doesn't go back to the center, if it takes about us, let's say, to the left of the center, if there is a reason to do that, the same reason would require that the beam takes a path that's to the right of the center because the circle is completely symmetric. Since the light can take two different paths at the same time, it'll have to take the only path that could be determined, and this path could only be determined by the center. It actually, I think it's related to the mode of determination of the circle. Because you only have one possible path that's unique in a circle. Just because of the circle being determined by just a position, but you fix the position where your laser starts, so you're left with one mode of determination, which is related to the region. Well, yeah. So if you advance that to the ellipse, it's similar, but now you have one more mode of determination. And so the light doesn't have to go back to the original focus that you started from. But no matter what, like the path that it takes, has to be somehow determined by the geometry of the ellipse. And if you take one of the foci and a point on the ellipse, there are two unique paths that you could certainly define that are not random. One of them is back to the first focus, and the other one is through the second focus. But since the ellipse is not...
I'm confused.
Why doesn't it just go anywhere? Because you said with a circle, like you said, if it goes like left or something, you don't have to go right too.
Well,
you said because it's symmetrical, you said light doesn't do that. Well, why not?
Well, because I was saying that the light beam has to take some path, right? It couldn't just disappear in the middle of its, you know, travel somewhere and disappear in the middle of space. It has to take some path, right?
That's who?
Huh?
That's who?
Well, that's what I think. I'm not sure why light doesn't disappear in.
Well, I think so too. I think it always goes somewhere. But the only reason I think that is because I've always like seen that happen. Like when I turn the light on, you know, it's working. It comes on.
Well,
like shining a flashlight or like this thing on here. When we turn it on, it does go.
Well, but if it appears at a certain point, there should be a reason why light should do that. If it's only something in space that causes light to disappear, then why would one region of space be different from another one? Why would light at least start propagating at all? Why wouldn't it disappear just before you it came out of the laser?
You're saying light has a reason for what it's doing?
No, I'm saying things in the universe have a reason for happening.
What if...
Who's reasoning?
What if there wasn't even any space? Would it still go?
I cannot answer that question.
They didn't teach you nothing in school. They didn't teach you nothing in school for it.
if you take a laser from one focus and then reflect it and then it goes to the other focus, then from the light that travels to that second focus, and it goes to that second focus, it's going to then reflect from that focus back to the original focus. Is that true?
What?
Does that make sense? Like if you shine from the first focus, if you shine it and reflects off the ellipse, and it goes to the second focus, well, it'd be like shining a laser from the second focus originally now.
Uh-huh.
It's traveling through. So it's going to reflect from that second focus off the ellipse again, come back to the first focus.
Right.
Yeah. Right?
That's what it looks like.
That's what it seems like. Now, what I was thinking was, does it travel the exact same? Does it... The original shining of light of a laser, and the one that's coming off the second focus, coming from the second focus, reflecting, is that the same line, the same trajectory, or is it a different one, causing it to create like various cycles, like a division of the ellipse?
I don't get it. Where are you going? Come here.
Just show what you're talking about.
This is our original focus, and it bounces up to this focus here.
Right.
See the angle of this one? It's kind of going in this trajectory. It's kind of going like at 9 o'clock or something. Pointing at 9 o'clock. Everyone see that? Then it goes to the second focus, the top one. And then it reflects off the ellipse and comes back down to the first original focus.
And there's a left one.
But then it's not this trajectory off this point here coming down will create a trajectory which will most likely end up.
Can you draw it on the board?
Yeah.
Whoa.
All I'm just kind of.
No, Nishaya were the first ones to the wall.
Right, the wall. Right, and it ends up at the second, right? And this is just, I'm just kind of, I never wrote this. So then it comes here, and reflects off this point of the ellipse. It'd be like shining a laser here. Mm-hmm. And so it's then going to. Now this is what I'm not sure if it goes directly to the first focus.
Try it.
It'll go through. Try and enter the wall.
Try it.
And then that state, and if it goes over here, right, if that was true, possibility, and it came over here, and it would reflect from here, and you create this kind of division of an ellipse.
You can do some productive when you're smoking outside.
No, it doesn't work.
Won't work.
No.
But we can't really be directly on. I mean, like,
curvature's not perfect.
Yeah.
We need better instruments. Donate more to the
campaign. Imagine if we had like a university caliber laboratory.
We just need a grant from the
room. Unstoppable.
Conceptualize.
No, man, that's work. That's
like
work.
It looks like a triangle.
Well, when it goes down there, I mean,
Yeah.
You see my hand?
It's going. Yeah, it's going.
My hand is right now being illuminated, so that's where the source is.
So it's reflecting back to the source.
It's not supposed to go back to the tip of the laser point. It's supposed to go back to our hand.
Yeah.
Hands on the front side.
My hand is on the.
I see it.
You can see my hand. It's back. It's already reflected. My body works.
Okay.
So, hold on. Alright. So I asked originally to get either a hopefully a hypothesis or a guess. Most of you guys gave me observations. And finally somebody actually...
Descriptions,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Actually gave a hypothesis that actually drove for some kind of investigation. Yeah, well, did you want to do something else on this? Okay.
Question.
This is more like a hypothesis. The only reason this thing makes sense to me that the light would take the path it is if I think of it as an orbit. So with the circle, you have one center point, and the reason that you have this radius and this string, the reason why it makes a circle is because, let's say, the gravitational pull of that center point is always equal. It's constant. The pole's not going to change. So the distance from the circle isn't going to change as you go around. And so if you just split that in two, you're just taking that, gravitational pull and halving it. So if you cut the ellipse in half, on one side you have what the light is doing is it's showing what a planet would do around these two foci. So one line is showing what the pull is from this foci, and then the reflection shows kind of what the pull is from the other foci. So the shorter it is, it seems like the stronger the pull. Like the closer it is to that foci, the shorter the line's going to be. And I guess it just shows what the gravitational pull is.
You're saying the gravity is pulling the light?
Well, in space it would be, yeah.
Well, what's gravity?
You're saying the gravity is
distance.
Light.
Yeah, it's the distance from the foci to, I guess, the reflection point, where it's bouncing off the ellipse.
Okay. Yeah, we can look at that. We're gonna.
What the light still work if you had an arbitrary point and its opposite?
What?
Well, the light still come back and have an arbitrary point and its opposite.
Well, what would its opposite be?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know what it means by opposite.
Let's say this is the ellipse. You have your point right here. You have two points. One right here and one right here. They're opposites, right?
Sure.
Those are the ones you have. Well, what if I chose to put the point right here and I put the laser, would it still come back? It wouldn't matter where the two points are as long as they're opposite of each other.
You're saying if they were arbitrary points, you're actually going to do the same thing?
I think you must get there multiple pairs of foci.
Let's find out.
Were you saying something?
I don't know.
Well, just that the actual shape is created by the two foci. It's not the shape that... Like, it doesn't matter where the two points are. Like, there will always be the shape that is from the two foci. Like, the light must hit at a particular angle so that the opposite angle will
hole and the result come back to that other foci. Like, it's not, like, that whole experiment wouldn't work if, you know, that shape was a little off or anything like that. Like, it depends on the two foci.
So to pick the motor point, there doesn't seem to be any convergence point. That's a guess.
Yeah. And we should look at some of this, these things. These are all valid things to look at. But, because it's interesting, because we just described, you know, a lot about this, you know, a lot of things we saw. You know, that was definitely interesting when Mike brought it up. But, you know, for the most part, the idea is that most people, yeah.
Reflected surface, when the light comes from the ellipse, it should reflect the surface. And then the other part of the ellipse, then if we differentiate the ellipse into two parts, into two small parts, and put one part here and another part here, when we put the light from the ellipse to this thing, it will hit at focus. And this other part should be kept at the focus of this mirror, of this reflective surface. And this surface should have the same focal length as that of this surface. And it will hit back at infinity at the point from where you are reflecting the light.
But what's going to impact at infinity?
If you keep it at the end of the ellipse, which is far from the focal length, which is double of the center of curvature. Double of the focal length means that it has an increased distance than the center of curvature. So when this light hits this mirror, then it should reflect to the focus of this mirror. And if this mirror is kept at the focus of the first one, at the same focal length, it hits back at the same point. And if these two parts are integrated one by one, then you
You're saying if the light is making an ellipse with its shape?
Yeah, I mean, if you take a part of the ellipse and put a light on it, then according to the reflected rules, it should hit at focus. It hits focus. And if it at its focus, if you put another part of the mirror with the same focal length, then the light, which is the another reflected rule, if it's passing through focus, should hit back to infinity, where your hand might be, or because of the swing focal length. And when you integrate those two parts, then you get where the hole is.
All right. Yeah, it was actually fun because I've been reading this book. You know, it's one of these great book series, and it's actually funny because it's got Huygens, but it's also got Newton in it. This guy's optics. You know, two works on the same subject, you could say. And I thought it was really interesting to counterpose, you know, that these two books, just reading through Huygens, trying to figure out, you know, based on some work, I'm trying to figure out the calculus and whatnot, that he worked with Leibniz and whatnot. But it's interesting, because here, like, I thought it'd be interesting to kind of, like, read you, like, the difference, the distinction. You can, I'll read you, this is the beginning of Newton's optics. Very famous book. Book 1, Part 1. My design in this book is not to explain the properties of light by hypotheses, but to propose and prove them by reason and experiments, in order to which I shall premise the following definitions and axioms. Definition 1. And does that seem weird to anybody?
He says experimentally and then he says definitions.
Yeah, my design in this book is not to explain the properties of light by hypotheses, but to propose and prove them, the properties, by reason and experiments, in order to which I shall premise the following definitions and axioms.
Through a list of about 100 axioms.
You know, to a lot of people, this is, or you know, most people, this isn't weird. Actually, like, some people may sound weird, but I mean, is that all we can really know about something? Is just the properties you can you see a bunch of things happening. You see light, you know, reflecting. You see things happening there, but how do you? I mean, like, why did you? Like, why did most people answer? Like, what? Like, did you like? What was your reason for answering, you know, when we asked these questions?
I was trying to, like, figure it out by looking at what was happening.
Yeah.
I was just looking through it. I didn't actually have an answer. Or I know why I started there.
Yeah. Yeah, because we see it. We see like, what's happening there. We describe what we see. But is that all we can know about? I mean, what about, like, what caused it to do that? Like, what's actually, can we ask that? Like, what's actually, because it's reflecting off, you know, it's reflecting off of this elliptical circumference. But why doesn't it reflect anywhere else? I mean, we say it doesn't, you know, it doesn't. You can look at it. We can see that, but why? I mean, is it crazy to ask why that happens? Because I mean, that's like kind of that was what we asked. But I thought it'd be funny because here I could read you. This is a counterpose. This is what Huygens starts his book out with, called The Treatise on Light. Chapter 1, on rays propagated in straight lines. As happens in all the sciences in which geometry is applied to matter, the demonstrations concerning optics are founded on truths drawn from experience. Such are that the rays of light are propagated in straight lines, and that the angle of reflection and of incidence are equal, and that in refraction the ray is bent according to the law of sines, now so well known, and which is no less certain than the preceding laws. But we all know that, you know, reflection, you know, equal angles, right? The majority of those who have written touching the various parts of optics have contented themselves with presuming these truths. But some more inquiring have desired to investigate the origin and the causes, considering these to be themselves wonderful effects of nature, in which they advance some ingenious things, but not, however, such that the most intelligent folk do not wish for better and more satisfactory explanations. Wherefore, I here desire to propound what I have mediated on the subject, so as to contribute as much as I can to the explanation of this department of natural science, which, not without reason, is reputed to be one of the most difficult parts. I recognize myself to be much indebted to those who were first to begin and do dissipate the strange obscurity in which these things were enveloped, and do give us hope that they might be explained by intelligent reasoning. But on the other hand, I am astonished also that even here these have often been willing. To offer as assured and demonstrative reasonings which were far from conclusive. For I do not find that anyone has yet given a probable explanation of the first and most notable phenomena of light, namely, why it is not propagated except in straight lines, and how visible rays coming from an infinitude of diverse places cross one another without hindering one another in any way. I shall therefore essay in this book to give, in accordance with the principles accepted in the philosophy of the present day, some clearer and more probable reasons. Firstly, of these properties of light propagated rectilinearly. Secondly, of light which is reflected on meeting other bodies. Then I shall explain the phenomena of those rays which are said to suffer refraction on passing through transparent bodies of different sorts. And in this part, I shall also explain the effects of refraction of the air by the different densities of the atmosphere. And I keep reading, but people get like a different sense of intention for like looking at this question. Who here doesn't get a different sense?
Who here is listening?
Okay. My design in this book is not to explain the properties of light by hypotheses, but to propose and prove them by reason and experiments, in order to which I shall premise the following definitions and axioms. Yeah.
What I don't get is, how does Newton define his experiments without first having a hypothesis?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that just intellectually dishonest to say that I didn't have that? It would be impossible. You would just be randomly experimenting with light. That's what he implies. That I'm not going to have these hypotheses. I'm just going to explain all these definitions. He didn't say that he didn't have them.
No, he did. He said, my design is not to explain the properties of light by hypotheses, but to propose and prove them by reason and experiments.
But doesn't, well, I guess what I'm saying is that doesn't the existence of an experiment imply the use of a hypothesis?
Well, what do people think a hypothesis is? A guess?
Yeah.
An educated guess. An educated guess. All right. Does everyone agree with that? No? A well-researched guess. Okay. Well, because, but that is what most people do when they think of this. When they think, okay, well, I'm going to actually try and figure out. Yeah.
I was just going to say, it strikes me also that, at least it seems to me that, like, you're already looking at what Newton's saying is he's going to try to explain properties. And it seems to me that in an experiment, you're trying to actually prove hypotheses. That you might use properties that you can demonstrate to prove a hypothesis that you have as opposed to avoiding the hypothesis and saying, I'm simply going to try to prove these properties for what they are. It doesn't seem like you don't really get anything from proving a property. Like, what can you do by proving a property?
Yeah.
So it seems like it's completely, you know, sort of squished around. Maybe use the property to explain and prove and demonstrate a hypothesis. But what, there's not much in and of itself in just proving a property.
Yeah. It's very essential. Like, it gets right, because it's funny, because most people, they study science or they do work on this. And, you know, if I had a mirror, I would have done, like, because we did some work on reflection, which is kind of fun because it's, you can go through it really rigorously. But, yeah, I mean, because most people, they, like, the care that they have of actually figuring out any of these things is mostly, you know, yeah, they don't actually think you can know the cause for these things, but also it's like, okay, well, what's the reason for knowing the law of sines or the you know, the equal angles law? All these things that people throw out, they're like, oh, isn't it? Why does it reflect, you know, the way that it does? Oh yeah, because it's the equal angles. Well, they don't know that. You know, they don't. It's just what you say. If you want to be overheard being knowledgeable about something, like you want to sound good, or you know, you want to get credibility, you want to graduate and have honors, you're gonna put that on the test. You're not gonna like write that what caused the angles was, I don't know, may God cause it or something, you know. But you're going to write down the answer, which is already established. And so, yeah, most people, like, but that's the real question, because it's... because you know, like, you can't, like, really look at these questions, like, outside of, I mean, because when you start discussing these questions, you know, of light, or you start, you know, we're going to talk later with curvature and you know, the history that we're going to go through with Harley and Filler, is it, you know, you really can't discuss these things outside of this fight that we're in right now. Like, you know, first off, you know, you can't really, like, look at the, most of us look at these things like isolated sciences, but, you know, for instance, with, you know, this method that we were talking about earlier, the method by which these people are lacking, that you run into this out on the streets, that they would actually be so impotent to actually deal with this crisis which is facing them, which is, could cause them, you know, must, which will, if they don't stop it, cause them much personal damage. But the method is, like, to actually know, like, what, like, how can you actually know, like, what's actually, try this. How about, can you actually hypothesize the intention for, like, if, say, you know, like, say that, like, you were the creator of the universe. What would you do to make that light did such a thing as this? Huh? Are people okay with that question?
Well, I would think if I didn't want my creation to fall apart, I'd have some sort of structure to some form, I guess, holding it all together.
Okay.
And so maybe, I don't know, then I would make light fall on that floor.
Yeah.
But unless you want it to be all chaotic and just, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I was thinking, because it's, you know, it's hard to, like, how do you actually address these kinds of questions with a truthfulness? I mean, because most people just address these questions just kind of, well, let me throw the things out that I heard. You know, I heard this and that about light. You know, and they just kind of throw something out. But I was just thinking, like, because when I try to actually think about how I could actually approach a question from a completely non-axiomatic standpoint, like how I could actually say something which is, how I could actually say something about this or figure something out about this which is not like that, I started thinking, well, like, what's the actual, like, what is it that you have to, like, start out with, you know, in order to be able to, like, look at any question? And I was thinking, well, I thought about, well, why I joined this movement? Because, you know, I'm not, like, studying light because, you know, it's not, I didn't just all of a sudden just come find a hobby, you know, in studying light for a little while, you know, since I joined. But I was like, well, you know, it's interesting. Dick Cheney's trying to take a look. But what about light? That's cool. But no, because like I joined this movement because, or the reason why I stay joining this movement is because that we actually have that we really have we have to actually realize to, we have to communicate to the people, not only in the United States, but around the world. We have to actually communicate that they actually have a creative power, which will allow them to change the situation. That they're actually affecting that we have to awaken in these people in the sense that they have this power to actually fight against this oligarchy and fight against Dick Cheney and whatnot. That as you saw with Cody, like, going through how we act, there's actually we can apply reason. Actually, we can know things that allow us to change our capabilities on the planet. and that it's actually necessary for us to develop. You know, that we have to. It's kind of silly to say, okay, well, we're just being tortured by God. Maybe Christian fundamentalists think that, you know, but like we're like kind of forced with a necessity to actually develop out of our present state. Despite how you want to look at it, you can be pessimistic about it and say, okay, well, shit, I have to work or something. But one thing you do know is that if we are forced to make that change. So the question should be, what ideas are going to be necessary to actually bring about that change? And I was thinking that with this also, like this idea that we are actually knowledgeable, that we for some reason we have this ability to actually know that we are in this crisis and that there are things that we can do about it. You know, there also is, you know, that we actually, there's an intention for us being here. And that I think is actually kind of, I mean, because whenever you start thinking about these kinds of, because the reason why I think it's important to look at light from this standpoint is that it's very much following an intention. And I don't know how people think about that. That light's actually doing something based on intention. Well, some of you know, you should think through it, but yeah, because it's very much like, actually, I was going to let John kind of go through it, finish up his panel, finish this, but yeah, because most times people just look at this deductive method. Or they look at this method by which you're just kind of guessing at things, just randomly, arbitrarily, like putting out things that will, like you say, sound good or get you by, or maybe get you a good career. But when it actually comes around to like how does what you're doing affect going to change the nature of policies in the United States to get LaRouche policies implemented, get LaRouche leading discussion and policy making in the United States and other places solving these economic crises, actually doing some good things, you know, at the world. You know, most people just kind of like back away from that concept and they retreat because they have the belief that they can't actually change the existing system. And so from that standpoint, it's completely necessary that we actually develop these kinds of things. And I think the only reason for people to actually think that they don't have a capability, like, because there's all sorts of explanations you can get from, you know, existentialists and whatnot, and say, oh yeah, but, you know, you can't do anything. You know, I'm just trying to be creative. I'm just trying to go out with a bang. But I can think the only reason you could really have for viewing yourself as an animal or some kind of underling that can't change anything, the only, because you try and reason it out. Like, what's the only reason there is? Is there? Can you think of a reason for why that would be necessary? Except to be enslaved? Is there any reason for thinking you're, is there any justification, any reason for actually thinking yourself as an animal, or that human beings are just animals and we can't do anything to change the world? Is there any reason for that except to enslave us?
The reason that it's enslaving people? Is the reason of enslaving people?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there's a lot of reasons, I guess. I'm not good, not like from this standpoint. Yeah, well, if you think about all the reasons you would have, they're all like kind of banal. You want to get some pleasure. You want to enjoy yourself. You want to make it through the day.
What if that's your sense of freedom?
Well, it's a false conception of freedom. You're going to be enslaved. The oligarchy is controlling you.
People who are in their
Huh?
I said, what if people are comfortable and they're busy, or they know? Do you just have to show them that all the darkness controls you? Or do you show them a world that doesn't have those types of eyes on them? It's something that you're enslaved. Somebody might say, shit, I love my slavery.
Well, you just got to move on and tell someone that guy's crazy. You got to do something else.
If you're making this connection between behavior and the idea of what your political social activity should be, like intention. But and then what you just said made me think about it. I was going to ask basically, well, what was the difference between what you're saying as intention versus what is kind of like thought of as fate or destiny? Right? Because I think it could be said that, well, the light, it has no decision-making process involved in whether it goes straight or goes to the right. It's not conscious. It has no mind of its own. It's kind of like something rolling downhill. There's a principle of gravity, and it must obey that principle. It's going to roll downhill. And just as the light is going to go straight because that is similar to something rolling downhill because of gravity. But like in terms of political action, you have a choice. You can say, well, I'm going to, I don't know, I'm going to stay in bed and pull the sheets over my head and try to push Dick Cheney out of my mind or whatever. Or, I'm just going to be a drunk. But the thing that you just said made me think about this kind of relationship, because if you have a certain intention, the consequences are predetermined. You will be fated to end up a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so, in that sense, is there always, is for a human being, even though you have free will, is there always some kind of way of acting that is like the light choosing the most efficient pathway? Is there like a path of least resistance or path of least action? Or how does it apply to what you're talking about? What is it? Like, are you saying that there's always a right way to act?
Well, all I could say is that you always are reasoning, hopefully, and if you have a method of making hypotheses about acting, which is truthful, then you're going to come up with the best way. That in your power to think about it, but I don't know. I mean, maybe someone else has a better answer.
I think it's thinking in terms of what's most efficient, like as far as politically organizing or trying to create some sort of situation. You're gonna look for the most efficient way to do that, right? Like Lyndon LaRouche. Everybody, a lot of people say, "Oh, that guy's crazy," but he saw the most efficient thing to do is first of all tell the truth. And expose certain people that nobody else would ever touch, right? And actually say, this is the most direct, best possible solution that you can come up with, even if it's not politically correct at the time. And you also study a lot of history, right? Historically, it was a lot of the times, I guess, there was youth movements that were studying possible ideas that actually created change, became the leadership of a certain population to get them out of the situation that they were in. And so even, coming out of prison, when his movement is almost virtually destroyed, he did it again.
Then that brings up the question of how does LaRouche, like 4 years before the fact, know that he's going to have to create a political movement to get out his ability, you know, to actually develop his ability to expose certain people, unlike certain people that know a lot of stuff and don't tell anybody about it.
How did he come for
years now? I mean, yeah, he spent like 4 years developing the capability that he used to go after these people. So there's so many different types of intention, and some are deeper than others. Maybe you could say that some are more truthful than others. But you can have the intention to do something that's superficial, but you don't really commit to it. So that it would never be efficient. You would never get anything done. So, even from that standpoint, it's like human beings, like whereas I can hypothesize that if you some kind of passion leads to action, you would still have to know a hell of a lot and find a way in advance to be able to do anything.
And have a true intention.
Right. And I was just thinking, well, maybe that is like, maybe that is like. And I was just kind of wondering what they thought about that. Maybe life, I thought I was really long and hard about this. I'm going to go straight from now on.
Ed, your question was about whether or not there's always a right thing to do?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, what's the relationship, I guess, between like kind of a knowledge of morality, a knowledge of the higher good, and kind of the efficient way that the universe acts? The universe seems to act simply, but consistently also. At the same time, like when you kind of add things together, the universe can be very complicated. And you kind of pick things apart, you realize, you know, it's kind of like your watch looks really simple, and then you open it up and you're like, oh shit, it's broken.
Mm-hmm. I got one thing to say, because as far as I understand so far, because I've been thinking about this a lot, of how did Lin become how he is. How is the universe so ordered? How is it so beautiful? Why does it exist such that you can have something like Mozart's Requiem or something like this? But when I do think about it, human beings are a bit of a different case, and I think that this kind of gets at kind of the enormity of the problem that we're facing, and it does really bring into perspective the kind of responsibility that we have to start to take as this youth movement, because it's. I think that, because in terms of this idea of like, are you, you know, fated, or is there always a right thing to do and things like this, I think the central determining feature of this is culture, right? Because if you're educated a certain way, you could come to believe or come to act with absolute conviction as if you did know that the right thing to do in a given situation would be to murder somebody, right? If they fuck with your family, or if they steal this from you, or somebody stole my violin. If I actually grew up, and you know, no, it's an issue still, right? But like, based on the upbringing that I've had, and now that I'm an adult, it's more based on the type of work that I'm going to put into my mind, right? And it's based on the way that I'm going to structure my intellectual life and structure my social relations, such that when any given situation like this occurs, like when you're at an intervention, right? Because I know this has happened to everybody, is that you show up at an intervention, you have all these grand ideas about what you want to do, and you end up punking out because you just don't have the courage to do it. Because your identity isn't yet in a place where it's going to be based solely on acting according to truth, the truth that you've come to figure out, right? But the thing with this question, I think, is it's definitely a relative thing in human beings. It's a relative thing. Lin's done a certain amount of work such that he can, you know, have insight into certain flints that are going to be useful for the political situation, or he can take the organization and give a certain speech that he knows is going to kick a lot of the crap out of the minds of some of the members and some of the boomers and things like this. He is who he is because he's done a certain amount of work. And what I was thinking, in terms of this panel and in terms of when we do actually come out of the weekend, it's like you know, there's going to be a lot of talk of Roosevelt this weekend. They're going to discuss Roosevelt. Harley's going to go over fundamentalism and things like this. He's probably going to get a little bit into the 20s and the Great Depression and things like this. But the thing is that if you have an economy And this is actually the crux of lens economics, and it is a principle. I saw this work one time at a recent deployment. The power of an economy, or the power of something to do work, I think is very... A central feature of it is the organization of the system, right? It's the organization of the process through which you're putting energy or putting energy into and getting work out of, right? The organization of the process is incredibly important. When you have something like an economy, right, the healthcare grid plays a completely, it plays a special role in terms of the economy as a whole, or like the electricity. Electricity generation centers and also the transmission grid. If you don't have electricity, you can't have a highly developed transportation system, or you can't have a highly developed, like a system of hospitals, a system of healthcare, and things like this, right? It actually takes a certain amount of organization. This is the same with like a factory. If you want to maximize the amount of output for what you're putting in, right? A lot goes into the organization of the internal process. And it's the exact same with your life. It's the exact same with your mind. If you're going to sit around and not do anything and refuse, if you're going to actually capitulate to the fear that comes from when you even think of doing something big, when you even think of doing something out there, right? Because a lot of what happens to me is I'll say, okay, I could do this and I could do that and wouldn't it be so great and organized and all these types of things? And I'd be like, well, what if I fail, right? And it's the asking myself, what if I fail, that sometimes has the power to paralyze me and not even let me try and go do the big things, right? But it's, I think a lot of it is in the question of how are we coming out of this and over the rest of the weekend going to structure our lives and structure our thoughts, right? Like, you know, really dirigistically approach ideas, not from the, like John was saying, you know, chains taken away, just like light, right? Not float around the things that we like to do, but actually look at the work we're doing from the standpoint of using it as an intervention into politics. So, if there are any more questions?
I also wanted to bring up this idea about we've been really talking a lot about like thinking in the mind and like what's going to be required of us and the movement as individuals. What type of thinking do we need in order to combat people like Bush and Dick Cheney? Like, what type of method are we gonna go about in going up against these guys? And not only that, how are we gonna? What is it gonna take to? What's gonna generate in our minds in order for us to be successful in organizing the population where you have 60 million people who actually voted for Bush and Dick Cheney? And something I was thinking about, if you can actually conceive of like some of these principles actually having an intention, like looking at the universe and understanding that if there wasn't anything holding it in place and ordering all the cycles, and that there was a possibility that the planets could all collide and the magnetic force like pull them together and then the planets are all exploding. If there was no intention in them actually holding together and not doing that, then I'm sorry. Then why do we still exist? And so there's this idea in our culture and society, if there isn't any intention for man to be here, I guess what I was trying to get at was this idea that the universe actually has reason, and there's actually some reasoning required of the human mind, required of civilization in order for it to exist. If there wasn't that reason about the universe that holds it together, then it would collapse and it wouldn't be here anymore. And so when you have a population that is no longer using, you know, hypothesis or the scientific method and how they're discerning what is true, if the population, the civilization doesn't have reason anymore, then you can conceive that that population, that society is going to collapse upon itself. And so, for me, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, how do I start thinking with reason? How do I employ that into my own method of thinking? And then how am I going to convince someone else or convey to someone else or lead them into actually being more reasonable in their thinking instead of just being very deductive, you know? And what is the danger of thinking deductively in a society, you know? Well, you know, using popular opinion in order to, like, form what you think is true. You know, where does your truth come from? If you're just reading it in a book, you know, and you memorize the definition, you know, how long is that going to hold up against what actually is truth, you know? How are you going to be able to fight when what you know to be true is just something that you've memorized from a book or memorized in a classroom that's been dictated to you, and you haven't worked through the discoveries and you don't really have a method of discerning what is true or not truthful? And so I think that that's something that I feel the panel was really trying to get at, was, you know, what is actually required of the individual in order to use more reason through understanding the universe, looking at how the universe does have reason and is logical, and it's not illogical or irrational. And yeah, I think that's all I wanted to talk about. So if you guys have anything else you want to add to that or any questions about that, that's more of what I was thinking in terms of.
Great.
What do you say to people who have an idea that science and morality are separate? Because you see this and you hear it sometimes. People tell you that it's a different thing. You can't, I don't really know how they want to explain it, but you can't actually place, I guess, human morality on the universe. But can you actually further human morality, or can you actually further, I don't want to say just human morality, but can mankind come to know more about his own nature through science? They come to know, like, become more and more moral through science.
Do you think that science is separate from mankind? Like, what would science be if there were no humans? Right? Like, where does science come from? Isn't that something that, I mean, the whole practice was generated from the human mind, you know? The concept of it. Yeah, Pablo.
Can I answer this question? Good. Well, it's an interesting question. Actually, I would ask what is morality. This is very interesting. Here's the thing. There are a lot of people, and if you ask them, they'll tell you that there is goodness. It's good to help us worse than that. And it's strange. How did all those people have the same idea? How did all those people suddenly decide you should be good? How did all those people suddenly know what is goodness? Is that not a principle of the universe manifested in all the people? Is morality not actually something in the universe that it can discover? Because if it was just generated by humans, you know, just sat around and said, oh, I think I should be good, like, I should just start helping people. I have nothing better to do. I've been watching TV all day. I think I should, you know.
go around and build some infrastructure.
I believe I've answered that. I'm a Christian, a real Christian. In the Bible, it says that like before God or the Creator, there was a word, but like if like something was like changed during translation, but I think like what the word was a message. It was a message, and I think maybe that's where morality might come from. And like morality was with God before He created the universe.
I think there's more than one word that's changed.
Yeah. reason? Well, but I mean, either way, it could be interpreted as the same thing.
Yeah, because I mean, what's science too? Because I mean, I know that there's the a lot of the environmentalist science, and when they say like what's morality, you know, they usually say, okay, well if those damn people weren't around, you know, this universe would be happy. Or something similar, you know. But how do they know that? Is what they do really science? How do you know what the Earth would feel like if human beings, you know, didn't mess with it so much? That's what I get this conception of morality, you know, because people do think that, or they think that we're bad, like what we're doing has an evil effect on the universe. I'm not denying Dick Cheney's pretty evil, you know, but how do you know? I mean, how do you actually measure how the universe feels about it? Yeah, what?
I may get a little bit of a wrong idea. Maybe I have kind of a little bit of a wrong idea about this class. But maybe this is just like kind of my own little fantasy. But this is kind of what I got from it. I was wondering if you could like talk a little bit how really like length determines the geometry. Like it's a certain like system, how you actually decide what actually the right decision to make in a certain type of thing to actually shift it to something. I don't know, maybe I told you.
How you decide what flank you'll take, or how the flank determines?
Yeah, I think it's hitting a little bit on the ideal of the morality as well. Like how do you determine how you're going to actually shape this geometry, or how you're actually going to take a certain plane? Maybe it's my own way.
That's kind of like Ed's question. That's a good question. Study like what's the right way of acting in a situation? Yeah.
I just got interested in watching.
interesting what this one acts in accordance with the principles of the universe. I think there is one very important principle to consider. And what is the principle that requires human beings to exist at all? And if there is such a principle, doesn't it require that human beings always exist, or maybe that there should be more human beings or something? Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty, if you want to consider morality.
Oops. Yeah, well, I think all these questions are really good. You know, I don't know everything, but I know this. For somehow, I think we all know that the reason why we came here this weekend was to actually look at these questions. And I could give you an answer to this question, but I'm still working on some of these questions too. You know. Well, there's a lot of questions there. I don't know. But I think the best question is Wes and Ed's question. How do you know it's the right way to act? Huh? Well, I mean, the only way I can put it is in the context when I started when we started talking in this class, just about how people decide to act not right now. I mean, we're in a breakdown crisis of the financial system, and people are going through poverty, people are suffering, and how they choose to act is usually based on things which are arbitrary. You know, they're not based on actually looking at what is going to actually be necessary to bring those changes about. They're not looking at that. You know, they're just looking at the immediate. They're looking at what's happening right now, and they do know, I think, that they're faced with they could really be in a whole deal pretty quick. But no, I mean, what's necessary, I think, is to actually, first off, you've got to actually use your reason, and it's kind of interesting because you actually know, I think, what you should do most of the time. But you don't do it because you're afraid, or because of some reason, you know, or for something that actually you want to do more than that, some passion or something. And I don't know. I think that's like somehow one of the most fundamental things we really got to break through in this movement, because I think a lot of people make a lot of bad decisions. But I think that I don't think that, you know, I'm not perfect. And I don't think that, you know, most people are, you know, they're going to make a lot of mistakes. But I think that's what's really necessary is that they're somehow involved in the intention to become to improve themselves addressing what is thrown at us as necessity. Like what we're faced with, which is wonderful, why we have actually the ability, you know, have this movement. It's a worldwide movement to actually understand the nature of what we're facing right now, you know, better than somebody who thinks that maybe believe that Bush is going to protect us because God like endowed him with certain powers to protect us from the Arabs or something. I don't know, but like we actually have like a sense of reality, and there's a lot of people that are in fantasy land. We got to really wake them up. I think that just that basic knowledge that we do know is actually so powerful that we are I think we're self obligated to actually go out and not allow people to act foolishly when we know what's right. So that's my idea of it. I don't know how long this panel's going to keep going, but I guess all night.
We have a question. So what about the light, the ellipse? I've been thinking about it this whole time, and I didn't hear really any good. I mean, I heard some good things, but I didn't get an idea of the intention of the light.
How it really works? Yeah. Well. I mean, because Well, the intention was really to kind of get the what people would do, you know, with looking at this. It was kind of more difficult to get all set up here. But yeah, Zoya.
Well, I've been thinking about the student in the discussion, which is like the question of intention. Sometimes it seems mystical, or it can seem mystical. You know, just to leave the discussion the intention of the item. But and this might maybe get it at this idea of exactly. Because the way I've been thinking about this just in the past few days, which is that when we talk about understanding the intention of the light or understanding the principle, I think we have to be careful in thinking that, because you're implying a certain idea about what a universal principle is. And I'm thinking that there's less and less you want to think about some distinct thing, like some distinct separate principle, and then you've got a whole bunch of these out there, you know. And the image that always comes to my mind is like marbles, a bag of marbles. Because if you think about it, at any state, you know, in our knowledge, it's you could say it's imperfect for one thing, but it's also not the truth. Right? You have this array, and every principle is universal. The fact that it's universal means that in every process you've got every principle acting. You've got this whole array and this connected array of things happening, you know. But in terms of our knowledge, we say, okay, but it's not our idea of principle isn't arbitrary, because when we use them, we can improve ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking that it's actually. When we think of our knowledge of principles, it's really relative. It's a relative thing in the sense that it's relative to a previous state of knowledge, right? And so I'm thinking that you can't even discuss universal principles without considering this process of, okay, you're going from one state of knowledge to another, which then that state will get superseded by another state. So, if that's the process through which we understand and even discuss principles, that is an intention, because what we call a universal principle is a change in our activity from one activity to another, from one level to another. And I was struck that maybe this is really what is meant when Lynn says that universal principles are intentions acting. It's our intentions expressed as changes in action, right? Because you can't talk about it like you've got a universal principle and that's it. What seems like what we call a universal principle is giving a name to this process, right? And so that's what I'm thinking in terms of an intention. That the intention is in how we're changing our mode of action along lawful pathways. But it's really hard, because it seems like you don't really have a language to discuss it. Like you just because then it can easily become mystical in your mind. Like you just got like light out there doing its thing, you got gravity doing its thing with planets. But that's like I'm trying to conceive of the intention, that it's how it's able to change what we do. And I got that from reading that this spring cleaning for the mind. I got it. I said it's provoked. The way Jonathan turned it on top of that. Because what I've gotten from these discussions, like in Oakland and here, which comes through to me is like just nothing really about light per se, but sort of a method. It provokes these questions.
Yeah. Yeah, we really don't know a lot about light. I mean, as a people. Yeah?
Well, that was definitely like way more interesting.
aspect of like what the light is doing now. I think that like just gathering from all the different discussions, right? How you asked earlier, well, if you were a creator making a universe, what would you do? Imagine who would you want it? And you come up against some of the tech too. You want it to be efficient, you want it to actually work, to hold together. Right? If you have an intention of creating a universe, it's not productive. And so it's gonna have this certain structure. And I don't know the structure of the universe, but it's like with the idea of a least action principle and creating a circle with a specific point in distance, you're getting the most area and the least amount of action. Whereas with an ellipse, it's pretty much the same thing, except that you've got two foci and your distance is from one of the foci to the opposite edge of the ellipse. But you're still, with those two centers, you're still getting the most amount of area with that one action. Are you following? You're just really confused for a second. Well, it just seems like I was thinking of it in terms of not really what's the intention of the light, but what kind of principles governing the action that the light takes.
Yeah, we should maybe break up a more formal discussion.